put his skin all in. So he kept the skin, put his on, just like a jacket. Go ahead, try it. So he starts swimming around. That's the one we see in the village. Got a long neck, little duck. Now this is how our Tlingit knows about, since that time, Chilkoot, they've been, have a story. I could sit here all day to tell you the story. This is what I want my children to know, my grandchildren to know it, my family to know it. So I'm doing this work. I try to do everything much as I can to help the family, not only me. This camp, I put it out for any village if they want to send their children to us to learn. So I have about 90 children this summer coming to Chilkoot to learn more. And this year, I got no way to build a place where the children could stay, where to lay their head down. I'm using the tent. That's the only thing I could use. They not allowed me to build any building. But this place is our village. The name of our community house, Kautliai Hit, they lowered down from the sun. I learned this from my great-grandfather, Joe Whiskers. This is his house, Kautliai Hit. The other house, it's a Shah Hit, Martin House. And the other house was there, it's a Lanater House, Kushtar Hit. All our family have been living there. So this village, it belongs to our Tlingit, not for one person, for everybody. So my grandfather told me to work for my grandchildren, my children, and my friends. So it won't be lost, this village. And they told me, you have to watch yourself. When the tide's coming in, that I heard a places that when the tide coming in, it's fast. It's hard to run away from it. That's what it's going to happen to you. That's what they told me. The white people's going to be run over you if you don't watch yourself. Now we see it, what they're telling me. All the things I'm trying to do to protect my grandchildren who needs to use Chilkoot. I was up, the government assistant just came down from there. I was talking about they have going to have the road there. About March, we was talking to them, and they told us maybe 10 years they're not going to touch it. But now it's changed. They're going to have the road through there, up above the lake. What we try to protect, the salmon spawning around the lake. If the road goes through there, it's going to be worse than before. The road was there. Hank Reed put it there. And all the fish streams are full up already that I see. So now if they put it there again, it's going to be worse. There will be no more spawning place. Not only this fish, up above there's a mountain goat, over 300 mountain goats they counted from the plain. And then the moose are coming down. If they clear cut up above the lake, where that mountain goat is going to go in wintertime and the moose. I try to protect everything much as I can for the grandchildren. I myself, I don't have much time to live. Only thing I do in it, what I say, my grandchildren. Maybe on my last breath, I'm going to say my grandchildren. So all these things, I've been trying to work on it. Now, this village I'm talking about, our village in Chilkoot, it's a lot of ways the states own it. Sea Alaska own it, BLM own it, and one for our native in Haines, they're holding it too. So they told me not to build any more building. But what can we do for our grandchildren? They need a help. I like to do, and I like to finish it. I was saying it when I was in Haines, before I came down at the meeting, talking there. I will fight as long as I live. I will do that just to protect my grandchildren. So I need a lot of help. I was mentioned, our people mentioned our Alaska Native Brotherhood, farther up Anchorage and farther down Seattle, Alaska Native Brotherhood. And I mentioned about the fishermen who tried to back me up. I need help from them too. All the fishermen from Seattle comes up to Haines. All from the different place, they came right up. Now I was going up to Haines, I see all the red buoys. They took in all the crab fishing that you could see in Oak Bay, they're selling it. This is our hometown. And I like to say about the land, the white people were saying we have sell our land so. But he didn't sell it up above from Burness Bay, they call Sunsmere Point. This is the story from William Paul Sr. He's my uncle. He was come up to us. The line is over by Sunsmere Point. If they took all these logs out and took the fish out from here and the gold, then we'll sue them. So you could see all that fishermen coming up to Haines, Chilkoot side, especially. So this is what I'm fighting for the people who needs. All the fishermen needs. So I will write a letter to all camp, much as I can, to help me up, to back me up, just to protect that little stream where the fish pond is. And the other thing they're talking about, spraying, killing the leaves, this is going to be the worst among the road if they spray it. When it starts raining, it's going to go down to the lake. All the fish ponds going to be killed. And I need your help, and I thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
My name is Franklin Williams, and I'm a shareholder of Sea Alaska. And I had a chance to testify last night. And I want to re-emphasize a few of the comments that I made last night. And I think I want to begin with the extinguishment of all Aboriginal titles to native land ownerships. And this is one act, I believe, that's been very devastating. I think this is the act that has caused a lot of injury to the Alaska Natives. The very intent of the Alaska Native land suit, as I mentioned last night, was to save the lands, land ownerships, and when we mention land suit, we think about a nation, an Indian nation, and we also think about the government, Indian government. The land suit was launched from the Indian government, village governments, to the federal government, government to government. But it was settled to the state chartered corporations. And it also became alienated from the village governments. And the way it is set up right now, with the settlement law, public law 92-203, and declaration of policies, this law is intended for the settlement, but it also represents a nation. But what good is a nation without a law that will ensure adequate government and that will also ensure justice? The settlement law it gives the federal government the right to keep the land under the Extinguishment Act. And this is not a law that the nation, the Indian nation, we have already had laws. We had land ownership laws. We had environmental preservation laws. And these laws were established under the laws of nature itself. But this law that we have in the settlement, it is not adequate. It does not represent us as a nation. And without a law, what are we? We're just a corporation. And another one that I'd like to bring up too is 1991, when the stock certificates becomes a transferable. The stock itself is our identity. It represents our nation. It represents our cultures, traditions, and it represents our law. How is it we're going to sell these things? When we sell the stock, we sell our identity. And this is something that is very wrong. A settlement was made to us without justice. I'd like to reemphasize this again. The land suit was launched under the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution. And we all know what these rights that are ensured under this Constitution are: life, liberty, property, pursuit of happiness, the due process of law, equal protection of the laws. But in CAKE, immediately following the Settlement Act, the wildlife habitat, prime wildlife scenic, was immediately destroyed, taken to satisfy the greed of the nation's economy and its needs. We watched the timbers being hauled away, and we also experienced when a deer or a subsistence resources left the island. The deer took refuge from the logging, itself, balloon logging. And today there's no deer on Kupanak Island, no deer on Kuyu Island, and no deer on Kiku Island. And this is food taken away from the table. And this is one of the reasons why I had to take and move my family from the community of village of Cake, because I wanted to come to Juneau and do a little study on my own to try to fight this Land Claim Settlement Act that we got. And I also would like to reemphasize that I did not, I'm not the only one, I'm sure there are many that did not want this settlement. This was a settlement, this is a fraud settlement, it's not settled under the law that was launched. Our forefathers' honor, trust, faith, and respect in the law, the supreme law of this land, the Constitution of the United States, was his honor. And I thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. And could I rip my testimony?
Yes, please.
Thank you, that's very helpful. Mr. Williams, just for the record, your statement is signed by you and by 19 other persons from Juneau, Angoon, Sitka, Douglas, Ketchikan, and Saxman. Well, we have time to hear from others before we stop for lunch. We'll come back again this afternoon at around 2, but we have a little time still this morning if anyone else wants to make a presentation. Well, I'm always in favor of stopping early for lunch, but so I think perhaps we might as well do that and start again at 2 o'clock, if that's that's all right. And any of you who would like to speak then, or any others who arrive and would like to speak, we'll hear from them at that time. I want to thank all of you who did speak this morning. It was a very useful morning. This afternoon, and I think since most of us were here this morning, just about all of us, we can dispense with any opening statement from me, but So, I think we can begin. If there's anybody that would like to make a presentation this afternoon, we're in these cozier surroundings, and I hope we can carry on in an informal way. The only person who told me that he definitely wished to speak this afternoon and would be here is Bob Arnold, the Deputy Commissioner of Resources. But we're open for business now, all those who are here now.
Proceedings this evening being here, will it be also here in the morning or switch back?
I guess it'll be here this evening. We had quite a good turnout last night, and I think it was good to have it in that other larger room, but our experience has been that normally the first night is usually when we have the largest turnout, and this seemed a little more convenient. But now's a good time, and Gene Strong says I'm going to have to entertain you, but I'm afraid that's not in the cards. Okay, that doesn't fall into the category of entertainment, but well, the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline Inquiry was set up to consider the social, economic, and environmental impact that a gas pipeline from Prudhoe Bay across the North Slope and then across the northern Yukon, that is the Yukon Territory of Canada, and then down the Mackenzie Valley, the impact that the pipeline of that magnitude would have. And so I spent 3 years in the Canadian Arctic and subarctic regions, Mackenzie Valley and the Western Arctic, holding hearings and listening to what people had to say about it, and that took altogether about 3 years to do. The report that I wrote was one that contained a number of recommendations about environmental questions, land claims, and of course the pipeline. And the major recommendations in the report were largely adopted by the Government of Canada, and the the result was that the result was that no pipeline was built along the Mackenzie Valley route, and that was to protect the porcupine caribou herd, which has its calving grounds on the Arctic coast of Canada and Alaska. And I recommended that wilderness areas be established there to protect the porcupine caribou herd, but that native hunting, fishing, and trapping rights be continued, and that native people, in fact, on both sides of the border should participate in the management of the herd and of the wildlife resources of the region. Steps, at least on the Canadian side, are underway to do those things. I recommended there be no pipeline in the Mackenzie Valley for 10 years, that is, until land claims had been settled, and a number of steps have been taken towards settlement, and indeed what no one thought was likely at the time, two new territories are being proposed in the Canadian North. One would be largely Eskimo in population, the other would be to a great extent Dene or Athabascan. So all of the things that were discussed at those hearings and were the subject of my report are still being worked out, because of course there are no, it's not as if anyone could put a kind of impose a final answer on any of these questions. They're always evolving and changing. That's been my experience anyway.
Native rights to subsistence, particularly with regard to certain species. And some of them are from the 17th century, some not the earliest seal to migratory waterfowl act, to the porcupine herd, and to different things.
Well, in Canada, there is really no national statute that protects native subsistence. The subsistence is in the Canadian North is now protected by the land claims agreements that are being worked out with native peoples. That is really, I think, going to be the principal protection offered to subsistence in the future. For instance, the settlement that has been initialed in the Yukon Territory, but not yet ratified by the native people, it has been ratified by the Canadian government, but not yet by the 12 Indian bands in the Yukon, gives the Yukon native people about 5% of the land of the Yukon in fee simple, but more important than that, it gives them equal representation with the Yukon government on boards relating to fish and game management, and it gives them the right to a certain percentage of the harvest of various species in any year. For instance, they're entitled to take 50% of all woodland caribou and moose. They participate with the government in setting the quota or the harvest limit. Then they get 50%, the right to take 50% of the quota or the harvest for the year. They've agreed that on some rivers they will have 90%. That as an illustration of the way in which they are, through their land claims agreements, trying to protect subsistence. Now, it's an issue, however, in wherever you have native peoples, certainly in rural areas in Canada, just as it's an issue here. It keeps coming up here in Alaska.
Is this the third branch of government that, as soon as I heard there's a third branch of government that deals with native issues, is this part of that, what it is, or is it just a new thing or something that the Canadian government finally recognized the native government or peoples up there, and so they have another branch of government that addresses the native issues as well as the other?
Well, in Canada, we've had, since the 19th century, a Department of Indian Affairs, which is the Canadian counterpart to the BIA. The Government of Canada, in March this year, recommended that the Constitution be amended to provide that native governments would be the third order of government, along with the federal government and the provincial government. All parties in the House of Commons agreed last fall to a report that came out in favor of native government. So that all of these questions that, you know, we find coming up in Alaska are coming up in Canada too, and they're coming up in Australia. The government of Australia has set up a national commission to look into land claims. And four of the six states, there are six states in Australia, four of the six states have now set up commissions to look into native land claims. And the same issues are coming up. The word sovereignty is used there just as it is here. It gets a lot of non-native people all riled up there just as it does here. So it's an expression that's worth explaining what you mean.
Do you find racism as open and hostile in Canada as you do here?
Well, I don't know. You know, I've been around hearing testimony in Alaska, but I haven't lived here, you know, all my life, so it's not really I'm not really in a position to comment on that, you know, I because my experience here is not that of a person leading a normal life, going to work and, you know, having a whole variety of contacts such as you would have if you were raised here and had spent your life here. So I don't think my experience is something from which you could draw any conclusions. It's not everybody in Alaska that I meet usually knows who I am and why I'm here, and so it's not as if I were just on the street or in the stores or at school or at work meeting people in the ordinary way. And I don't think that experience, therefore, is It's typical.
How would you characterize the testimony received in Anchorage from South 48 Indian representatives on the one hand, and those people who came from other countries, I think Australia, possibly Canada, or those would be two groups? Would it be possible to characterize what their testimony seemed to focus on?
I think that might be a bit difficult. The thing that makes the Alaska situation comparable to Canada and Australia and even to Scandinavia is that land claims is a subject that has current in the sense that land claims were settled here by act of Congress in 1971. They're being settled in Canada and in Australia now. Negotiations are underway. The Sami people in Scandinavia are now obviously launching a campaign to settle their claims. In the lower 48, the situation is different in the sense that treaties were made there, and current land claims comparable to those that were settled in Alaska in 1971 or that are currently being negotiated in the Canadian North or in Australia. It seems to me that's the distinction between what's going on, but it's clear from the evidence we heard in Anchorage from Native leaders from the lower 48 that questions relating to the powers of tribal governments are very much on their minds, just as those questions are on the minds of Native leaders here in Alaska. But the vocabulary relating to shares and corporations and 1991 is unique to Alaska. That is not to be found in the lower 48 or in any other country.
And lower 42 is usually concerned about the question of land being held in trust status and the preservation of the trust relationship between the Alaska Natives and the federal government, so as to not seem to advance. And furthermore, so it's not to seemingly advance a precedent for changing that. I think some of the representatives argued during the lobbying phase of the Claim Settlement Act that serious consideration should be given to receiving, if possible, a land in trust status as one means of preserving one aspect of tribalism.
Well, certainly that's a big distinction between the way in which land is held by Native people in the lower 48 and in Alaska. Here it's largely held by corporations. In the lower 48 it's held in trust status. Are you, you're getting all of these, I'm kind of...
They are the only lands in our villages that have not been lost. particularly in Southeastern. And when I mean lost, I mean that they have any control over at all, because they certainly don't have control over the village lands or over the regional lands or over the other federal and state lands around them. I mean, they don't have any control over them like they used prior to ANCSA. You know, they really didn't. They didn't try to boss them around on their own lands like they do now, like they have to get permits and they have to do things within seasons and stuff. In fact, I think that's probably the most terrifying thing about this whole ANCSA Act, is that there are so few people who are able to participate in it. As far as Alaska Natives are concerned, you know, it's virtually a settlement for the white interests. Really not related at all to Native interests, because Native interests have to do with making a living, holding on to lands, having a right to their own way of a subsistence lifestyle. And it's that to me is the scariest thing about ANCSA, because when I go back home now to the village, those people no longer feel that those lands are theirs. They no longer have the right to go out and get abalone when they want to. They can no longer go out and get deer when they want to. They do not have the right to live off the land anymore. And that, to me, is the most terrifying thing about this. And also that they don't have a voice as far as the management of their natural resources. And they all feel powerless about it.
Yeah. What village is that?
It is no longer possible in our village to live there free anymore and live off the land and to fish in the summer and be able to live the lifestyle that they choose to live while in a village, you know, that of being a Native living off the land. When we were growing up, you could work in the cannery or on a fishing boat and be able to feed and clothe your family for the winter and subsist off the land. That's no longer possible. So they are constantly being threatened by housing for eviction. They're constantly being threatened. They have their telephones and TVs and water and sewage and lights turned off. And these are people who have absolutely no opportunity of employment. So where the state and the federal government has gone in and changed their life, put them in homes that are totally electric, that have running water, where these utilities are astronomical in price in comparison to what we in Juneau pay, and they have virtually no way of getting out of the poverty we are putting them in, and we're subjecting them to.
Nettie Paranovich, and I was born in a fish camp near Heidelberg, and I was raised in Indian boarding schools and prior to that in Indian orphanages, and I grew up and decided I wanted to be a teacher in order that kids would never have to live through what we did during those days. And prior to being allowed to go to an Indian school, I lived with my grandparents in Heidelberg. I think my reason for becoming a school teacher was rather romantic. I ended up being the state director of Indian education for the Alaska State Operating School System. Excuse me, I'm very nervous.
Can I get you a cup of coffee?
No, thank you. I traveled in over 260 villages in Alaska, And during the 60s, I worked in the interior area when land claims was getting started, and we used to raise a lot of money in order to get all of the 44 Taranoff villages involved in the whole land claims movement. In those days, you never heard anything about sovereignty or IRAs. And since I had grown up in an IRA village, I thought that was for people who owned boats and things like that. The only type of government that I noticed in traveling the 44 villages in the early 60s and up in the what is now the Nana region, when we were setting up local school boards in the Nana area. The only type of government that I ever came in close contact with were the traditional governments, and they were very live and well in all of the communities, including the North Slope Borough. There were certain people who were acknowledged leaders, and they pretty much had the say-so in everything, whether it was somebody getting married, somebody going to school, or who was going to take care of all the sharing, or who was, you know, the main boss around. So as far as I was concerned in those days, those were kind of the bosses. The whole native land claims movement were pretty much young people in their early 20s and 30s. And people who were sort of involved in the poverty program, because that was how they could travel and what provided them with money in order to sort of consolidate the so-called native opinion about getting this land claims across to as many people as possible. And in those days, the poverty program did provide all of the travel money, all of the meeting monies and everything that made the whole effort possible. When we did send representatives from the Fairbanks area into Anchorage, like to the 68 convention and stuff like that, it was at the direction of the 44 Taninna chiefs. They decided who the leaders were that went to Anchorage. They were not speaking for themselves it was collective in those days. It isn't like today. Like today, the corporations and, you know, the village governments and everybody are sort of fighting amongst themselves. But in those days, there was sort of a consensus and a collective way of coming at decisions. Whether you were in the North Slope area, whether you were in the Nana area, or what, you know, like we worked extensively in the Taninna area. I was at the University of Alaska at that time. The biggest thing that I noticed about all of the elders, the older people, when if they would very seldom ever come to a gathering like this, we would have to go around to the houses and talk to them and stuff and ask them what they felt and what they thought and everything. And the most important issue in their mind at that time was the land. And that they didn't want white people coming in to tell them or boss them around, really is the best way of putting it. And the big issue in those days, other than the land, was the right to have an educational say at the local level, because at that time we had a state-operated school system and a Bureau of Indian Affairs system. We had 150 villages under the state system, which we then decentralized. Because of my travels through all of these 150 villages, I realized that that was the most important thing that they wanted. So we decentralized state-operated schools, and we organized parent committees in every single village, including those like Petersburg and some of those where there was a lot of racism. We still organized native parent committees at those area, at that level, in order to get local control down to those schools. So other than land, education was the most important thing. The other thing was that they didn't want white people coming in to tell them what to do. And that is, I think, this sort of emergence of this whole sovereignty or this want of self-government, which they had always exercised. I mean, ANCSA was something where they were going to be able to protect their lands, and that was something that kind of the young leaders were taking care of. But there was still that local control at the local level. And then after ANCSA started selecting lands, you know, the corporations through ANCSA, and then of course the village corporations started selecting lands, all of a sudden, you know, they begin to feel like, where's my land? I mean, this is what we all agreed to. So they all feel like somehow or other they've lost this self-government, this right to run things in their own village. And I think a reflection of this loss of control at the local level is the high suicide rate that is astronomical since ANCSA. And these, I don't know whether you want to call it hopeless, but also because of all of the new housing and improvements and everything that the government has put into these rural areas, it's almost impossible for them to economically get by. And so they sort of feel hopeless about the whole situation. And it has nothing to do with IRAs. IRAs did very well in Southeastern during the 30s and 40s here because fishing was good, because the whole United States was being fed off of fisheries of Southeastern. You know, they were going through a depression, we were going through a boom. But then in the 50s and 60s, when the fisheries fell off, then of course IRAs sort of became dormant. But of course, after ANCSA, Judge von der Heydt, you know, in the Chilcat case, said that IRAs are well and alive, regardless of the fact of why they're dormant. And that sort of spearheaded this whole new thinking of that might be a way we can have some land. And I think it's a searching and a thrashing around of some way for them to have some land. And some people want individual lands, and some people want lands collectively. And I think what traveling I've done in the past 3 and 4 years in the interior and up north is kind of a collective feeling that we didn't have during land claims. You know, land claims, it was, you know, we wanted to assert ourselves, we didn't want reservations, we didn't want any government interference, we didn't want this, we didn't want that, we wanted to be able to do it ourselves. Well, economics and land and everything are too complicated, we can't do it all by ourselves. So now there's sort of a collective feeling out there where we want to have our lands, you know, not just my land, like we were thinking before. But you know, the problem with Alaska Native corporations is that it isn't basically democratic. It isn't basically collective like we're used to traditionally. The financial resources of our corporation are just too great for Alaska Natives, and besides the financial resources, they have this overwhelming political power, so that if anyone or any group goes against a person or a corporation or disagrees with them, they have total power. You know, they can have you fired from your job, they can make it sure that you don't get hired someplace. You know, like myself, and thank God I don't belong to this regional corporation, but in 19, 1980, I wrote a letter to all of the stockholders in my region and told them that we were losing several million dollars and that this creative accounting by a regional corporation shouldn't be tolerated. And our regional corporation came down here to the Alaska legislature, had a law passed that a stockholder cannot send letters out to stockholders without it clearing through the corporation and Bankings and Securities. So that means that there is absolutely no way at all for a stockholder or a group to fight a regional corporation. They have not only political power and financial power, but they have the power of intimidation, just the threat of using all of these resources. I spent 2.5 years in court fighting my corporation that was suing me for $10 million. If it had been $10,000, I probably would have jumped off the Captain Cook building. But $10 million, I figured I was worth something.
The corporation,
Ms. Pradovich, the regional corporation you're speaking of is...
Oh, it was in the newspapers for 2.5 years. They had us in court. It's an Alaska Native corporation. Mm-hmm. It's probably the most financially well-off one now.
Right.
But at that time, it was not doing all that well. But I think, you know, as far as what our expectations were in those days, we never expected regional corporations in Alaska to try to become like Exxon or IBM. We never expected that. I think what we expected is to be able to organize as a corporation, but I think we thought we were going to get involved like in my region in mining and oil and different things like that and into small businesses, and that we would include our stockholders in economic development and in managing their own lands and their own villages. I mean, I really had this very romantic idea about how all of this could be accomplished. And here, our region corporation spent $4 million hiring all these land managers and all these other people to select our lands when we had lists and lists and lists of all of our elders in these villages that we wanted to assist in selecting these lands, and we wanted to pay them and things like that. And, you know, it wasn't possible. You know, we had this big crush and rush and thrust of money, and which really is amusing today because it's taken, you know, 12 years and my corporation still isn't through selecting lands. And at that time they used to shove us out the door saying, you know, we have all these land managers and we have all these resource people and we're spending millions of dollars on them, you know, and these people don't know anything. But right where we selected oil lands, where these elders did, is exactly where they're making money from now. And, you know, every piece of land that the elders said was valuable and what it was valuable for, the resource people came in and told them. You know, we paid extraordinary amounts of money for things like that. And we still are. We're still paying a lot of money for these same resource people. And we're still paying extraordinary amounts. We average over $4 million a year in land selection, which I've always found amusing since this was supposed to be a land settlement and a cash for economic development. And I think that the government should pay us back all of that money, if indeed the corporations are going to exist, and that this government payback should only be allowed to be used by the nonprofit arms of the corporations, and that it should be used for economic development and to help out the elders and all of the other hopes and dreams as to the reasons why Alaska Natives went along with the land claims. That's all.
Can I ask a
question? You said that because of improvements in housing and services in the villages, these improvements are paradoxically keeping people in poverty. I think I know what you mean, but could you, for the record, explain that phenomenon? Because that's something we've run into elsewhere.
Because I'm not from this region, although I was born in this region, so it's easy to speak as a stranger, so no one has to feel guilty that I'm talking about their region. In a housing program in several villages in rural Alaska, over 60 of them received notices that they would have to vacate just before Christmas. And this was because they did not pay their rent and they were way behind in their payments. And it was a federal housing program, you know, a HUD program that the federal government had gone in and had decided that these people were poor enough so that they built them houses. Now they can't keep up the rent in order to live in them. You know, and not only do they get the houses, but they also get the electricity and all the utilities and the sewers and everything else that goes with it. And these houses are substandard in that they are very difficult to heat. The pipes freeze up, the electricity. Some of these houses don't even have two doors, you know, in case there's a fire, there's no escape. And then the porches on most of them that I saw this summer were way too high that if kids even got out of the place, they'd die jumping over the porches on them, you know. So basically, not only have they given them very, very expensive homes to live in that they cannot afford to keep up, but they're also very unsafe rat traps and virtual clapboard houses that cost them way too much money for the product that they're getting. Utilities in rural Alaska are astronomical. It costs them more in utilities than most of them make in a year. And sometimes in the Anchorage papers you can see just pages and pages of people in rural Alaska's names whose telephones are being shut off and whose TVs are being shut off if they don't mail in their payments and stuff like that, you know. And the government is the one who made all of these things available for them. And certainly it was with their consent, but nobody at all let them know how much it was going to cost.